You are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freib.
Hello, Richard.
And Lionel Burney.
Hello, chaps.
Hello, fellas. Did you both watch and enjoy the tour of the Basque Country?
Yes. That was a curveball. You mean it's Zulia, Rich?
Yes. We are going to talk about the tour of the Basque Country a bit later on, aren't we? But I'm sure we were all glued to Paris-Roubaix. Did you watch that?
Certainly did, from start to finish. Barely missed a minute of it yesterday.
You, Daniel?
I didn't see all of it from kilometre zero, but I saw from, I watched from about 150 kilometres to go.
Was it vying with golf?
Well, Rich, and funny you should say that, because I was going to ask you a question. What do the winners of the US Masters and Paris-Roubaix this year have in common? Remarkable comebacks from knee injuries. Both left knee,
yeah,
Tiger Woods and Philippe Gilbert.
I guess, yeah, Gilbert had a terrible crash at the Tour de France last year, didn't he? And I think some of us thought at his age he might struggle to come back from that, but he's come back very well indeed. And
unlike
we'll talk a lot
Tiger
about
Woods,
Philippe Gilbert. It's taken Tiger Woods longer, hasn't it?
Yeah, and there was also no string of affairs, sordid affairs, in Philippe Gilbert's case, I hope.
No.
Also an element of the Tiger Woods story, lest we forget.
Goodness me, I thought the lawyers were going to have an intervention there, a little word. Gilbert's got quite a striking dress sense. I could imagine Gilbert in a kind of Belgian champion's jacket, sort of yellow sleeves, red front, black on the back, maybe.
Well, actually, napalm.
In leatherette.
The green jacket, the hallowed green jacket, of course, is associated with the, is synonymous with US Masters, and not the most fetching garment in any other context. But I think it's probably a more appealing piece of clothing than the bronze pinstripe jacket that Philippe Gilbert wore at his wedding. if you care to look that up, it's pretty shocking. Anyway,
and probably as flammable. I don't know. The green jacket, the Masters green jacket looks like it would go up if you stood too close to a radiator. But anyway.
It's like a cheap tracksuit. A cheap Watford tracksuit from the 1980s. They don't get more flammable than that, do they?
Cycling podcast derby tonight again, Rich, another one. We'll go on to cycling in a minute.
Yeah, which derby is it tonight?
It's Watford against Arsenal, against the mighty Arsenal. Of course, cycling podcast derby last week, Arsenal against Napoli, Napoli being Ciro's team, and first leg 2-0 to Arsenal.
And we're having to record this before kickoff, just in case we're not speaking tomorrow morning, Daniel, isn't that right?
Correct.
Well, we'll hear a little bit from an Arsenal fan in my package from Paris-Roubaix. Did you like that? Marco Haller. Quite a story of Marco Haller, and we're going to hear a bit more of that as well very soon, aren't we, Daniel?
This is like a rich cake of non-cycling-related ingredients.
Yes, exactly. I was at Paris-Roubaix. Thanks for asking, chaps. I was there following the race, probably not watching it as closely as you, Lionel, because I tried to get out there on the pavé, which I did, and I chose my spot very well, even if it was kind of by accident. But anyway, that was great. We'll hear my package from Paris-Roubaix in the first part after the news roundup, and we'll hear some interviews in there as well, including from Dirk De Mol, the sports director at Katusha Alpecin, whose writer Niels Pollitt was second, of course. But all that's to come. Can we have the news roundup first, please, Lionel?
Indeed we can, Rich. Well, as we've said, Philippe Gilbert won Paris-Roubaix ahead of Katusha's Niels Pollitt, with Gilbert's De Koninck Quickstep teammate Yves Lampaert in third place. It was Gilbert's fifth monument victory. He now has 4 out of 5. Milan-San Remo is the only one missing. Can he win Milan-San Remo in the little time he has left? He's 36 now. He's not got much longer to go, but he could join Rick Van Looy, Eddie Merckx and Roger de Vlaeminck as the only men to win all five monuments. And I've been wondering since yesterday, if he were ever to do that, what should the prize be? There's no real prize other than the honour of it. I wonder whether perhaps Gilbert would be presented with some kind of dinner service with the race logos on or something. I can imagine him in his
dinner
retirement.
Service?
Yeah, you know, like
get out his wedding outfit again for that.
I can imagine him in years' time eating soup from a Liège-Bastogne-Liège branded bowl, maybe. I don't know, perhaps that's just me.
Never, he didn't win any of the monuments while riding for BMC, supposedly in the peak years of his career, though. That's one of the oddities. But we're going to talk about Philippe Gilbert, so I'll save that for then.
Another great week for De Koninck Quickstep, who have been the one-day kings of the spring. Fabio Jakobsen won the Scheldt Prize for the second year in a row. There was quite a noteworthy attack by Edvald Boasenhagen in sort of the final few kilometres for Dimension Data. Bold, but it came to nothing. Chris Lawless was also third for the second year in a row for Team Sky. So that's kind of the cobbled races done and dusted for this spring. It all switches to hillier races from now on. Brabantse Peel coming up this week, and then the Amstel Gold Race, and then Flèche Wallonne and Liège-Bastogne-Liège will round off the spring. The stage races will be emerging in those races, and they've been tuning up for that in the Basque Country at Itzulia, where Bora Hansgrohe really, well, they dominated the week, but then didn't win overall. Max Schachmann won three stages. Emmanuel Buchmann won the penultimate stage, taking Schachmann's leader's jersey. The pair of them, I think, were roommates for the week as well, so no animosity there. But then Buchmann had a bit of a shocker on the final day, lost the jersey. He was distanced. Adam Yates won the stage, and Jon Izagirre of Astana continued their remarkable spring of stage races by taking the overall win ahead of Dan Martin. But Buchmann, who had been chasing very well, was accidentally sent down the deviation in the final kilometre. That's the road that goes off for all of the race vehicles that don't cross the finish line. They are directed off into the car parks, and Buchmann was sent down there by accident. And a couple of hours after the race finished, the results were adjusted so that Buchmann was given third place. They kind of neutralised the time loss, so probably did the right thing there. One of the other stages was won by Julian Alaphilippe. The following day he crashed, but he will be fit for Brabantse Peel this week. In Spain, the Clásica Primavera was won by Carlos Betancourt of Movistar. His first individual win for 3 years. His last win was in 2016, although he did win the Hammer Series climb stage in 2017, so before the pedants take to Twitter to point out my deliberate mistake. But that doesn't count as an individual win, I don't think, because it's a team race, isn't it? But anyway.
You covered yourself there, Lionel,
yeah,
don't worry.
Yeah, just covering all bases. The Circuit de la Sarthe saw Mathieu van der Poel back in action after his pretty heroic Tour of Flanders. He won the opening stage. People were asking why he didn't ride Paris-Roubaix. Well, apparently ASO did want Corendon Circus to take part in the race, but van der Poel is the Dutch champion and instead took it easy, got some stage racing miles in his legs, and will be at the Amstel Gold at the weekend. The Circuit de la Sarthe was won by Alexis Gougère of, I think, AG2R. The Healthy Aging Tour in the Netherlands was won by Lisa Klein of Canyon SRAM ahead of Ellen van Dijk. There are a couple of stage wins there for Kirsten Wild, who was also third overall. Victor Campenaerts is going to tackle the hour record tomorrow night in Mexico. We've talked about this a few times over the winter and the spring. We will find out whether he's got his preparation right and can break Bradley Wiggins' hour record. It's at altitude, though, and when we discussed it before, we thought he had a decent chance. But we shall see. We shall find out. And the 2020 Giro d'Italia, the next year's Giro, will start in the Hungarian capital, Budapest, with a couple of stages in Hungary. Well, three, in fact, in Hungary before transferring back to Italy. So we'll be looking forward to that. Never been to Hungary.
You've definitely been hungry, though, haven't you, Napalm?
Yeah.
I can vouch for that.
Yeah, indeed.
Almost usually on the Giro, you're hungry every day.
Oh, well, it's so good, though, isn't it? The food is so good at the Giro.
Bit of goulash in Hungary won't go amiss, I'm sure.
Lashings of goulash. Some news that broke just as we were putting this episode together is that the 30-year-old Colombian rider Harlinson Pantano of the Trek Segafredo team has recorded an adverse analytical finding for the banned drug EPO after an out-of-competition test taken on the 26th of February. Pantano, who won a stage of the Tour de France in 2015 in the Alps, has the right to have the B sample tested, but he has been provisionally suspended by both the UCI and his Trek Segafredo team.
The fastest clothing in the World Tour. The home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Ratha in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
The two most important things are a saddle and a chamois or a short, and you want it to feel good. I am Sepp van Marke. I ride for EF Education First. In the past, I struggled sometimes with the saddle sore, and with the new shorts, I haven't had any problem yet. So I really like the new shorts. They said it was a new model of chamois. For me, the bib shorts are the best that I ever had.
Thank you very much indeed to our headline sponsor, Rafa. We heard there from Sepp van Marke on his Rafa bib shorts, which he's wearing in 2019. Rafa's core collection has just launched. It includes the Rafa's entry-level shorts, the core cargo bib shorts, which have been updated to offer everything you need for every day on the bike. They allow you to carry more whatever the style of riding, featuring the same hugely popular pockets on the legs and back, which were first introduced in Rafa's Explore collection. Whether it's a spare gel on a mountain effort or a camera on a weekend adventure, carry more of the things that turn rides into memories. The core bib shorts have been given full mark reviews by Road CC, Cyclist Magazine, Velo News, Road Cycling, and more. For more information, go to rafa.cc. Also go to rafa.cc and subscribe to Rafa on YouTube to follow EF Gone Racing throughout the Spring Classics. Now it's over to me and my report from Paris-Roubaix.
There will be one winner at the end of this épreuve. Ainsi démarre donc cette aventure et le long cortège de véhicules, à commencer par la voiture numéro 2, à bord de laquelle on retrouve Thierry Gouvenou, le directeur de l'épreuve, ainsi que Sébastien Piquet.
Well, there go the riders of Paris-Roubaix, last man away, Sylvain Tillier, who was second, of course, to Peter Sagan last year. They're setting out from beautiful, cold but sunny Compiègne for 27 sectors of pavé. And I'm just mulling over whether I should try and get to a couple before heading to Roubaix and the finish. Just don't want to miss too much of the race. But I spoke a little bit earlier to Jared Gruber, the photographer, and he put me to shame a little bit because he is managing to get to an incredible number of sectors. It requires a lot of planning, and I spoke to him about that just before the start. 13, you're going to see them in 13 sectors today.
Yes, I think so.
Can you name them all?
No, I can't. I can work backwards. At the end, I'll see him. So sector 4 is car 4, right?
Numbers will do.
So that would be 4, 5, 6, 7. In that little section, you can see him a bunch because they kind of loop around. And then before that, it's so hard. That's the one thing that's really hard about Roubaix is like picking everything out because there are only a few that really stand out. Just trying to fit them all together.
Is 13 a record for you or is that regular?
I'd say that's what I would hope to do for this race.
And what's involved in that? Obviously, a frantic day, but a lot of planning as well.
Yes, definitely a lot of planning and a lot of staring at maps and a lot of satellite images, a lot of Google Street View, a lot of any kind of possible map research I can do that allows me. And also experience now because I know what works.
And in terms of the roads you use, you mentioned single track roads, off roads.
Yeah, we do end up in a few areas that are definitely just little trails through the forest. And that's just like exit routes and stuff. Or at some point early on, you'll see if there's helicopter footage, you might see like 10 photographers just going straight across a green field. It's amazing.
Ever had a disaster? Ever missed, ever managed to get stuck behind the race or anything?
No, at this point we've been pretty solid and it's been smooth going, more or less. It's usually close, but it's worked out. We don't do too much in terms of like getting on the course once the race starts. So we usually just come up to the race, and so it's easier to do that. Whereas if you're trying to get in front, it gets a lot more complicated because then you have to get in front of the lead car and things are complicated.
Can you take in any of the race? Can you enjoy any of the race doing like this?
I would say pretty much no. Once it really gets going, I just see people coming at me or see people going by me, and I just try and get pictures. It's weird. It's the weirdest thing to know that you've seen the race 13 times or more, and then you say, I'm really not sure what happened.
But then when you look back on the pictures, do you get a picture of sorts of what happened in the race?
Sure. If I look back at the pictures, I can definitely piece it together. But usually what will end up happening is I'll watch the race while editing, and I'll just have it playing in the background, and then I'll see the pictures, and then I obviously piece everything together, and it all makes sense. But up until that point, sometimes you're just like, I have no clue what's happening right now.
Well, I wish you good luck.
Thank you. I definitely need it today.
That was the sound of the front group going past. Big group, almost a minute now they've got. Helicopter overhead. It means the bunch isn't too far behind at all. But Marco Haller driving hard on the front there for Niels Pollitt in the group. And Matteo Trentin has been doing an awful lot as well for Mitchelton Scott. Surprising to see. He went a bit too early at Milan San Remo a couple of weeks ago. Is he going way too early here? Here come the bunch now. There they go, Alexander Kristoff just off the back and being helped back up. Looking out for any more of Daniel's tips, Daniel's top 18 among the back markers there, but hard to see. Bernie Eisel riding his 15th Pirate Bay was pretty close to the back as well. I know Edvald Bolsenhagen punctured recently, so I'm not sure if he got back on or not. Well, I'm in the centre of the velodrome in Roubaix. 21 kilometres to go in the race, and Philip Gilbert has really been at the centre of things over the last 60 kilometres or so. And it's heated up to the extent now that he's actually taken off his long sleeve training jersey. But the guys who've emerged at the front, Wout van Aert, is an incredible ride by him. He was off the back, he crashed. Had mechanical problems, change of bike, but he was up there in that leading group that formed around Gilbert, with Peter Sagan bridging up to him and taking with him Yves Lampaert. Niels Pollitt was up there with Gilbert, he's still there. Got Sepp van Marck, but it's all breaking up now, it's fracturing, and Van Aert has been left behind. Van Marck is with Lampaert, but ahead of them, Niels Pollitt, who's been out in front for so much of today, Gilbert and Sagan. It was Gilbert that initiated this move, and the three of these riders look very strong and maybe good for staying away. But seeing Niels Pollitt at the front for so much of the race, and now in this leading three-man group, it's a good excuse to play an interview that I recorded yesterday with Dirk De Mol at the presentation of the teams in Compiègne. The start, Niels Pollitt looked very good last week at Flanders. Yeah. I guess he's your leader for tomorrow.
Yeah, definitely he's my only leader, and what he proved the last couple of weeks, Harderwijk and especially last Sunday, is promising.
So he's, I mean, is he a potential winner of this race, or is it, you know, it's a very open race, no real clear favourites tomorrow?
Yeah, I think so. When you have a larger group of favourites, when you say like 10, 12 riders, he's one of them. It can be a very open race without a real leader. And to answer on the question, can he win? Yeah, I believe he has for sure the potential. I don't know if it's going to be this year, or but for sure he has the potential to win soon a big monument.
What's he like as a rider, as a person, as a leader as well?
He's still, I don't say he's a born leader. I mean, he's a strong athlete, a super nice person to work with. I'm really happy with him. Also, he's making steps also in the race by example. Also, we can hear him on the radio already that he talked to the teammates, and we have still on a couple of things that he need to improve. But yeah, he can be a future leader.
And he's got a DS who's won this race.
Yeah, it's a bit ago. Eh? No, but going back on this overall team, I mean, I know that the race of tomorrow is a race who fits us not bad, because also we have Jens de Bucher, who was last year 10th. Always top 20, top 25. And then Marco Haller is in super form. So I would be a bit disappointed if we should be not in the game. I think when everything goes well, you will see us.
You turn away a second and look back, and now it's Niels Pollitt and Philippe Gilbert away. And I bumped into somebody whose presence guarantees there will not be an Italian winner today. Ciro.
You know, dear listeners, I'm really happy when Italian riders win, but you think that this would mean more work for me. So maybe I'm also happy with this exciting final, because we are seeing this marvelous battle between Niels Pollitt and Philippe Gilbert. So it's not bad.
I should explain, you have always been at Tour Flanders, Giro, but you weren't there last weekend, and there was a double Italian win in the men's and the women's races.
But I had a good reason, because as I think our listeners know, I was at the Tour of Sicily.
How was that?
Tour of Sicily, four stages, listeners, beaches, but also a lot of fog. This was really, I was a little bit upset for this, because, you know, the beginning of April in Sicily, there was the same fog and also more that normally I can find in Pianura Padana near Milan. But in any way, I was here.
It was nicer in Flanders, Ciro.
Yes, but in any case, Richard, you know that for me, cycling is not the priority. I mean, I'm here just,
You're here for the listeners, aren't you, Ciro?
Only for you.
And on that note, Ciro, we've got a problem at the Giro, because Lionel Burney, of course, is going to have to come home to watch Watford in the FA Cup final. Do you know anybody who can stand for him at the Giro? Any thoughts, any ideas?
This is not very professional from our friend Lionel, I guess, because I can't understand how is it possible to leave Giro to see a football match. But also, I could also be in his place. So our listeners don't have worried, because if maybe Lionel is not in the Giro, my presence in the podcast will be the double. Who knows?
Giro issues are come and get me, please.
Exactly.
And who's going to win Giro finally?
Between these two guys, I go with Philippe Gilbert. Not because I'm against Pollitt, but for the story, you know. Four monuments out of five, only San Remo miss for him. He already won the world, and he is almost 37 years. So not ready for the retirement, dear listener. But I want to
You'll
know
retire
you.
Before Gilbert.
I mean, in 4 years, hopefully, I will be retired. So maybe before then, Gilbert.
That's them entering the velodrome, Pollitt and Gilbert, with Yves Lampaert chasing still. Get to show their track craft here. Pollitt up the banking, Gilbert just stalking him. Lampaert enters the velodrome as well, and he's sort of looking across, wondering, I think. I don't think it's possible for him to close the gap now. At the finish, I also spoke to two Austrian riders, Bernard Eisel and Marco Haller. Eisel starting and finishing his 16th Paris-Roubaix, and Haller almost a year after a terrible crash when he was out riding with Eisel and he was hit by a car, almost lost his career, almost lost his leg. So it's a remarkable story for him even to be here and performing such a valuable role for his teammate Niels Pollitt. Haller finished 16th in the end. And one reason for going and speaking to them was, we've got a friend special coming up that Daniel has been working on, and it's been following Haller and Eisel, but Haller in particular, through his recovery and rehabilitation and return to the top. That will be coming out very, very soon. It was an emotional Haller in the velodrome who hugged Pollitt and could reflect on his podium place, but also his own 16th place, which was, as I say, a real achievement for him. We'll hear first from Haller and then from Bernard Eisel.
Like all this classic season, always being there, you know, I mean, obviously not taking a great result, but always being there in the final after this hard year last year. It's, for me, it's unbelievable that really nobody can understand what it means for me. It's probably one of the most emotional moments of my career, for sure, because doing a monument podium with a friend of mine, with a teammate, after what happened to me, being there with him very long in the final, I'm so super happy and super proud.
I mean, you were a great teammate as well. You really helped him. He's finished second in the end. You've also produced a result of your own, so I guess, yeah, the feeling must be a one of elation, is it?
Yeah, I really cannot describe it. And as you said, the race was on even before the first cobble section. I was there with him in the big group. I know Niels has the legs to win this race. He was so close, and like, I knew I had to dig deep and work for him, because this is such a big chance, and coming home with this result, it's phenomenal, and just so happy and proud. And yeah,
you got 15 done then.
16
today. 16.
16 I was.
You came off at one point, you didn't seem very happy.
No, because I told him, a guy who crashed me there, like, okay, he didn't do it on purpose, but I told him 5Ks before, take it easy, mate, we're all fine here. And then you come around that corner and it's just one guy takes it, and it's just in front of you and you have nowhere to go. I'd landed on my feet, but it's just like no cast, no way to come back. Frustrated.
I spoke to your friend Marco Haller, who did an amazing performance today, and of course his teammate was second, so he was really happy. It's almost exactly a year after his crash, and I guess you're reflecting as well on how far you've come over the last year.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm stoked. If Marco is happy, then it's a good. Niels Bollitt, chapeau for second place, and Gilbert too, heads up. Now he won every single race out there, and but it's, for me, definitely where I came from. But I texted my brother yesterday, and it's like, with a bit of luck, podium is possible. And of course, I was dreaming high and aiming high. But at the same time, I had the legs, and when you just land on, okay, I didn't hurt myself at all, but no cars, nothing, and you just chase for 40Ks for nothing.
It's got to go right in this race, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's, of course, I mean, it's at the same time, you know, you see it happening to many riders where it goes, it works out every, looks like every year, and I just couldn't do anything, you know. I was in 10th wheel, I was at the front, and still got taken out, so it's like I could still, I made it through.
Back for number 17 next year. I think that might be a record.
17 start and finishes of 17 would be a record, but at the same time, the guy who has 16 with me now is Servais Knaven, who won one, so I can keep trying.
Well, at the finish, I grabbed a word with Patrick Lefebvre, the boss at De Koning Quickstep, as he began to reflect on Philippe Gilbert's victory here. I also spoke again to Dirk De Mol, the sports director at Katusha Alpecin, whose rider Niels Pollitt was second, of course, in the end.
Reaction, was that the plan today? Was Philippe Gilbert your leader, or was it him and Lampaert both had sort of equal billing?
And Stibart.
Yeah. And so the way the race played out, was that pretty much what you expected?
Well, he's the oldest, he's the strongest. He has to work from far from the finish, and what he did, he was the first to attack. And then in the final, I think also Yves Lampaert did a hell of a job, and he killed a lot of people in the front. And yeah, the rest I think you saw in me.
It was a bit, the blueprint was almost his Tour of Flanders when he went almost about the same distance. Was that in his head, do you think?
Yes, he has to do it like this, because he has to make the race hard and try to kill the others.
A lot of people thought Gilbert was maybe too light to win Paris-Roubaix. Did you ever have any doubts about that?
No. He can win everything.
He can win everything. Can he win Milan-San Remo now?
Yes. If it's a very hard race with wind and rain, yes.
He's not slowing down with age at all. He's not slowing down with age.
He's like the wine, he becomes better.
It must feel almost like a victory, does it?
Yeah, it feels... of course, when you are so close and second... But it feels I'm really, really, really happy with it. The last couple of weeks we have been in the picture all the time. We have been in the game. We finished fifth in Flanders today, second. We were already sixth in Harelbeke with Niels. So also a tenth place with Jens de Boucher and Gent Wevelgem. And I have seen a super Marco Haller as a teammate, and now I'm really happy with what I have seen of my team the last couple of weeks.
We spoke yesterday about Niels and his prospects here. Were you surprised and worried to see him going out so early as he did, or was that the plan?
No, it was the plan. I mean, with the team we have to anticipate a little bit. That is what we have done also the last races, with some good results, and we were again there. Like before the Cobbs was from one moment to the other, was a group of 23 riders gone, and he was there, but with the best teammate he could have. So it was a perfect situation. He could just hang in there and save some energy to use this later. And now. It was in the plan.
And it wasn't a lucky second place. I mean, he's one of the men of the race.
No, exactly. So when you see at the final, who came in the final, all world top riders, and he was there. So, and that's what I said also on the radio to him. Don't be impressed about the riders that you're with on the road. You belong to them. You belong to the world top in this kind of races. And super happy.
What were you thinking as he came into the Velodrome with Gilbert?
Yeah, I didn't watch anymore. I was. Just hoping on the victory, but the other side again, super happy with his second place.
Well, that captured the sounds of Paris-Roubaix, Rich, but where actually were you out on the cobbles?
I was on Sector 26, Kievi à Saint-Piton, quite early on, so about the fourth section, if I'm not mistaken. Quite a long section, quite up and down. I parked 5 or so minutes away from there, walked there, and Patrick Lefebvre was on that very spot, so I figured it was a good place to watch the race, and it was. It was, you know, the countryside around there is very, very rural, obviously, but that sort of beautiful, rolling French countryside. You know, people, I know this is a hobby horse of yours, when we think of Paris-Roubaix as a pancake flat race, but, you know, it's undulating, and in places, those undulations are quite significant. It was a great vantage point, actually, and I had a good day out, and then raced to the Velodrome and got there in lots of time for the finish. You heard me chatting to Ciro Scognamiglio there, who it'll come as a relief to you, promised to cover you at the Giro, which is good news. And and then I lost my car when I left the press room. I couldn't find my car. I was looking for an hour.
Oh, I can imagine. It's a different.
Oh,
can picture that facial expression.
Different car park. Problem is, when you arrive, all the infrastructure for the race is up. So the landmarks that you notice when you arrive have all gone by the time you come out the press room, the team buses, and the fences and so on. So I came out, and I was in there for quite a long time, and Everything had gone, and nothing looked as it had looked a few hours earlier, and I was completely lost, stomping around the Roubaix streets.
I bet you were. I must admit, at the tour, I do make a special effort to just remember where we've parked, because I know you just don't. You just get out of the car and stampede.
That sounds unlike the Buffalo.
The wherever.
Well, I missed you. I missed you yesterday, then, Lionel, is the conclusion. But let's talk about the race, because it was a very absorbing race, if not a classic. We were talking about this just before we started recording, and whether it was a great Paris-Roubaix or not. Certainly a great winner if you look at what it's done to Philippe Gilbert and his legacy. I found it a thoroughly absorbing race with some great stories, and just the way that it unfolded, with that big early move. You know, where I was standing, as I say, the fourth sector of Pavé, when they came through, Marco Haller was driving it at the front, and a few hours later there he is in the Roubaix Velodrome hugging Niels Pollitt, very emotional, given his own journey back to fitness from his terrible crash last year. So it was a race where some of the teams and riders that really took it on early were rewarded in the end.
Yeah, definitely. De Koenig Quickstep being one, Katusha being another, but there were others. There were people that were prepared to take it up and risk everything early on. That big move you're talking about that went clear, which had Niels Pollitt in it, nearly 170 kilometres from the finish, an awful long way to go. And I think that's the thing about Paris-Roubaix, is that it wasn't the greatest edition ever, but even a kind of middle-ranking edition of Paris-Roubaix just keeps you on the edge of the sofa all day, really, in a way that other races often don't. And just to see, you know, how it all came together at the finish and then put into context in your mind just how De Koenig Quickstep laid the foundations for Gilbert's win. You know, Tim de Klerk, Yves Lampaert were both off the front in that, what was, well, initially the kind of chase group that then bridged up to the nine leaders. They did everything. They did everything they could to give their team leader the best possible chance of winning. But the big question for me was whether or not that was the plan at the outset. And it always makes me think, is it possible to plan a race like Paris-Roubaix? Because we saw with the riders that did everything right and then suffered bad luck, most notably Matteo Trentin, who got into that chase group along with Pollitt. You know, it could have been him at the finish, but for some badly timed punctures and then the energy that he required to try and drag himself back into any kind of contention, you know, takes its toll in the end. Similarly, Wout van Aert, who really kind of lit up the race in so many different ways, a bit like Mathieu van der Poel did at the Tour of Flanders. You know, some incredible bad luck for Wout van Aert that cost him in the end. And when you get to the finish and you see Philippe Gilbert, you almost can't quite believe the coincidences of good fortune, good decision making, and good legs that go into putting together a result like that.
No, you're absolutely right, Napalm, and it's the one story where every member of the field, every rider in the field has a completely different story for the day. In most races, you would have, you know, the races like Milan-San Remo, where everyone's story would be pretty much the same until the last 20 or 30 kilometres. But it kind of strikes me, I don't know if anyone has ever done this, a magazine or a newspaper, but it'd be really interesting to just have a sort of paragraph from every single member of the field, just briefly telling the story of their race, because they would all be completely different, and a lot of the time the real story never gets out because riders are trying to protect, particularly I think equipment manufacturers. So when they talk to journalists, they're sometimes quite reluctant to talk about the mechanical problems they experienced. I mean, yesterday I was watching French coverage, and there were at least two or three occasions when they talked about rear derailleurs, so DTI Shimano rear derailleurs, or you correct me if I'm wrong, but the SRAM and Campagnolo equivalents also have the same crash mode, which blocks the rear derailleur, which is a particular problem, I think, in Paris-Roubaix, because the bike is, the impact is such that the kind of derailleur often goes into, well, can easily go into crash mode and block the derailleur. And I think that caused problems for a few riders yesterday.
Well, one rider, Daniel, who really struggled in the key part of the race right at the end was Sepp van Marck of EF Education First, who had bike problems. He changed his bike at one point.
I think that
he was on Sebastian Langeberg's bike.
I think that was exactly that issue, Lionel, wasn't it? The rear derailleur blocked. That was certainly what was said on the French commentary anyway.
And that was extremely bad timing and misfortune, because it really ruled him out of playing his full part in that powerful six-man group. I mean, what a group to be a part of. Peter Sagan, Van Marck, Niels Pollitt, Van Aert, Lampaert and Philippe Gilbert. I mean, the riders that didn't make that move, which went kind of around the Mont-Jean-Pével section 11, I think. The riders that missed that will be kicking themselves today. Greg Van Avermaet particularly, but also AG2R, who then took up a lot of the chasing. Stijn Vandenberg then did quite a lot of the chasing for Oliver Naassen, but that was the move. And it's so easy for us to sit and watch on TV and say, well, that was the move, why did everyone kind of fall asleep and not mark it? But yeah, real misfortune for Sepp van Marck. And then it was, as we so often see, a numbers game, with De Koenig having two riders to everybody else's one. And from that point on, you would have thought that one of the De Koenig riders would win it. But it was interesting to me, at least, that having watched the whole spring, seen how much work for the team Yves Lampaert has done, and just kind of because we played that interview with him from the start of the year when he talked about how much he wanted to win Paris-Roubaix, and then I saw the pictures of him on the podium looking as if someone had, well, I don't know what it looked like. It looked like somebody had punctured all his birthday balloons, quite frankly. I wondered what the strategy was, but Gilbert knows that in these races, if you hesitate, you give somebody else the opportunity, and he set out on the front foot and got the job done. So the team will be happy if perhaps Lampaert maybe not quite
footnote,
so.
I think he to that line, or I think Rich will confirm this, but Lampaert was certainly very magnanimous and certainly seemed very happy at the finish. But he was also, in a way, returning a favour that Gilbert had done for him at the Belgian National Championships last year. Lampaert was away and Gilbert effectively blocked behind him.
I think that, I mean, Lefebvre said that they'd started with three leaders, Stibar, Gilbert and Lampaert. And I think one of the things that plays into Gilbert's hands is the fact that he's one of three leaders as far as the other teams are concerned. So when he goes with 72 k's to go, and actually it was Niels Pollitt who initiated the winning move. In the feed zone, yeah, having been off the front all day, he then attacked and Gilbert followed him. All the significant moves came, as we often see, not on the cobbles, but on the tarmac between the cobbles. But Pollitt went and Gilbert followed, and Rudy Selig followed as well. But I think, you know, it's almost as if some of his rivals will be looking at him thinking that he's the softening up guy, you know, and he did it last year, remember, at Paris-Roubaix, and it didn't pay off. Mm. But last year at Paris-Roubaix, Stibar and Gilbert were very, very aggressive very early on at a similar point in the final 100 kilometres, and it didn't work out then. But it's the kind of blueprint of Gilbert's Tour of Flanders victory, where he was in that big move, I think on the Eau de Quaremont, Tom Boonen was there as well. He was probably the big favourite. It was his last season. And Gilbert just rode away. And it wasn't... I think that some people might be looking at him thinking, well, he's the guy, you know, he's maybe the number three at Quickstep, at De Koenig Quickstep. He's just softening people up. And so, you know, Sagan did well to come across to that move eventually. But I think that's one of the... I mean, I mentioned... his relatively barren spell at BMC, where his only really significant, he won Amstel Gold at least once, he won the World Championship as well, but it's a pretty quiet few years. We didn't win these kinds of races, and I wonder if that's part of the reason why.
Well, maybe Daniel had softened everybody else up by saying that Gilbert was too lightweight to win a Paris-Roubaix a few weeks ago.
Well, we speculated about that, didn't we? I'm not actually sure how much he weighs at the moment, but he's usually listed as about 69 kilos, which would make him the lightest Paris-Roubaix winner of the 21st century, I think, and maybe the lightest for sort of 30, 40 years. But I always feared that he'd discovered Paris-Roubaix or he'd turned his hand to Paris-Roubaix too late. And I think we've spoken about this before on the podcast. There have been a few riders who have got towards the end of their career and have felt that they gave it a go a bit too late in Paris-Roubaix, regretted not having done it sooner. Michele Bartoli was one similar sort of rider to Gilbert, maybe lighter than the classic Paris-Roubaix rider. I think Luca Paolini was similar. But I mean, Gilbert has took this route 3 or 4 years ago to where he decided that he was going to give it a go and concentrate on trying to win Tour of Flanders and Paris-Roubaix. Wouldn't have given him much hope of winning both of them, but he's done it now.
But what about Niels Pollitt, Rich? Because he was in that early move. He was then in everything that really counted, and it was his aggression on the Grusson section of Pavé with around 15k to go, which was the one that sparked what turned out to be Gilbert's winning move. And yeah. So Gilbert must have recognised just how strong Pollitt was. And he's been a bit of a star this spring, fifth at the Tour of Flanders, yeah. Sixth at E3, and really rescued a pretty wretched season so far for Katusha.
Yeah, he's the man that wouldn't die. I mean, Gilbert paid tribute to him as well in the press conference, saying that he was very pleased to be with Pollitt. He said he knows him very well, and he's always a very generous rider in breaks, which means, you know, he works hard. He doesn't hide. I suppose I first became aware of him, became slightly more aware of his personality, weirdly, through listening to Ian Boswell's Tour de France diary that he recorded for Friends of the Podcast last year, because they were roommates, Pollitt and Boswell, and I quite enjoyed the fact that Pollitt refused to be on the podcast. I mean, Boswell got him on a couple of times, but he was quite reluctant. And he came out, he mentioned this in his press conference too, but he came out of that Tour de France. He rode well towards the end of the tour, and he came out of it very strong. He rode extremely well at the Tour of Germany, and he looked like a different rider. And he reckons that, and we've spoken about this a lot, what the Tour de France can do, or finishing a Grand Tour, can do to a rider, and I think he is a transformed man since coming through that tour, and he's been one of the strongest riders in the spring. I spoke to him actually at Skelderpriest because I was surprised to see him ride there. A lot of the Paris-Roubaix riders weren't riding there. Sepp van Marck was, but not many of them were. And I asked him whether that had been a dilemma. He said he'd missed Gent-Wevelgem, and so he felt like he needed another race in his legs before Paris-Roubaix. But yeah, the fifth at the Tour of Flanders really showed his strength, and it's why I picked him for the podium in my pre-Paris-Roubaix selections. I went for Oliver Nasson as the winner, Niels Pollitt second, and Yves Lampaert third. Not bad, I think you'll agree.
Not too bad. Two out of three, pretty good. Daniels didn't even have Philippe Gilbert in his pre-race top 18. Ah, dear. But on Pollitt, I mean, he's a young man. He's only 25. And sometimes in Paris-Roubaix, you do see these kind of what look in hindsight slightly anomalous performances. I'm thinking, Martin Cialinghi's been on the podium. Sylvain Dillier's been on the podium. There was a French rider whose name currently escapes me. Sébastien Turgeot was on the podium in 2012. And you know, their results that don't then get followed up, replicated in, you know, races of this stature. But Pollitt looks like the real deal, doesn't he? I mean, a potential winner in the future. He's got years on his side, certainly.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, race radio at the Tour de France, to remind us to tell you that this week's episode is sponsored by The Week. Now, on the cover of The Week, there are two strap lines that have caught my eye. The best of the British and international media is one, and all you need to know about everything that matters is the other. And that pretty much sums up what The Week is, because it pulls together the best and most interesting articles and opinions from over 200 different sources every week. And on the same page, you can see an article from, say, The Guardian, a slightly left-leaning paper, or The Daily Telegraph, slightly right-leaning paper, sitting side by side. And in that sense, it gives multiple points of view on the most important topics, and perhaps a more 360-degree view of the news than you can get from just reading one particular newspaper or website. It's a magazine as well, so handy, and you can read an awful lot in quite a short space of time, as I've been doing on my weekly train journeys in to record the podcast with you, Rich. But what's caught your eye in The Week?
Well, as you say, Lionel, I'm guilty a bit these days on social media of sometimes just reading the headline or the tweet and thinking that I know the story. This gives you, a lot of the stories in The Week give you enough to be able to have a conversation with somebody about something and pretend that you know what you're talking about, which is very handy. A story that caught my eye was on the health and science page, under the headline, "Are eggs bad for you after all? Should you go to work on an egg or not?" And eggs have kind of drifted in and out of fashion, haven't they? Are they good for you or not? Who knows? And I'm not sure that we do know yet, but a recent study in the US tracked 30,000 American adults for 17 years and found that eating just 3 to 4 eggs per week was associated with a 6% increased risk of cardiovascular disease and an 8% higher risk of dying from any cause over the study period, which is really quite remarkable. According to the study's author, our study showed that if two people had the exact same diet and the only difference in the diet was eggs, then you could directly measure the effect on heart disease. But aha, said some other scientists, because they noted that eggs in the US in particular are often eaten with sausages, bacon and burgers, making it hard to disentangle the impact of the eggs from those of those high-fat meat products. Had the study been conducted in Asia, for instance, it might have had different results. So, still uncertain whether we should be cutting back on our eggs or not, but very interesting. That's still a topic of such debate.
Do you know what? I read that story as well, Rich, because we keep chickens, and so we have a lot of eggs because they are regular layers, and I was slightly alarmed until that last paragraph, as you say, because I often eat my eggs with just toast or avocado, so probably all right.
Well, this is the beauty of science, isn't it? That it's a continuing conversation rather than a full stop.
Indeed. Well, you can join thousands of people who trust The Week as their essential curated news source, trying the first six issues completely free. Visit theweek.co.uk/offer and use the code cycling. That's theweek.co.uk/offer. And use the code cycling for your 360 degree view of the news.
So Philippe Gilbert, I've actually got the race on my screen at the moment, watching it again, and I'm struck watching it again just how much work Yves Lampaert did. And you mentioned, Lionel, what a workhorse he was and has been all spring. But it did seem that when the two of them made that move, that the decision almost was that Gilbert was the favoured son of the pair of them, because Lampaert did seem willing to do an awful lot of work to help that move and to help Gilbert.
Yeah, you guys are saying everything's all hunky-dory at the finish, and I'm sure it is. When the team wins, everyone's happy, and the job is for the team to be on the top step of the podium. But Lampert's move when Gilbert and Pollitt were away in the final kilometres, where he was in risking pulling riders across back up to the when that group of six first split, he was risking pulling Van Mark and possibly Van Aert back up to the leaders and making it a lot more complicated for Gilbert. It all worked out in the end, and of course in bike racing the ends justifies the means, but that looked a very odd move at the time to see. I know he was trying to get out of that group rather than just drag them across.
At that point, Napalm, was it not Sagan, Pollitt and Gilbert?
Yeah. So he's risking taking Van Mark and Van Aert.
Worsened. De Koninck's position with Gilbert versus Sagan and Pollitt was worse than it would have been with Lampaert, Gilbert and the four others, would it? Is that not?
Yeah, I guess. Saw it? But you're not supposed to drag other riders back up to... Once, you know, Gilbert was proactive in getting in that move, wasn't he? He wasn't, unless he was just marking it. I mean, it just looked a bit odd, that's all. You've got Gilbert up the road with the other two, and then Lampaert is going hell for leather, and really all he's succeeding in doing is towing at least one rider back into it. I don't know, what do you reckon, Rich?
I mean... I don't know. I can't really remember the bit that you're talking about. I said earlier about the all the action happening on the tarmac. I'm watching the Carrefour de l'Arbre again and noticing just how strong Gilbert was there and how much damage he did there. I think it's really difficult to manage these riders. It must be really difficult to manage these riders. And Yves Lampaert is 28 now, and he's won Dwars door Vlaanderen a couple of times, but you know, he's missing one of these big ones, and he wouldn't be a bike racer with ambition if he wasn't slightly wondering when he's going to get his chance, because it does look as if he's been pretty selfless, certainly this spring, but in other last couple of years as well. He'll hope, I suppose, that there'll be payback time eventually, and if he looks at Philippe Gilbert, who's 36, he'll maybe think that he's got a good few years left.
Yeah, to be fair, I mean, it was in a phase of the race. It wasn't right in the finish. It was around 22, 23 kilometres to go. So there's still a lot of racing still to go. But it still looked a little strange to me. But, you know, what do I know? I'm just an armchair director sportif. They
What about Gilbert, though? I mean, what does this do to Gilbert and his palmarès and his standing in the kind of pantheon?
Well, I think if there's any doubt about him being the best classics rider of the, what do we call this decade? The teenies? As opposed to the noughties? Well, I think we can definitely say that if Paolo Bettini was the best classics rider of the noughties, then Gilbert has been of this decade. I find it quite difficult to split those two riders. I was just looking at their respective palmarès. Gilbert has the greater diversity of monuments. Bettini never won Paris-Roubaix or the Tour of Flanders. On the other hand, Bettini won two world championships compared to Gilbert's one, and he also won an Olympic gold medal, championship of Zurich, which is no longer around. Bettini won that twice. Any thoughts, chaps, on who you would have higher out of those two in the pantheon?
Well, there's this curious period in Gilbert's career at BMC where, you know, he had that incredible season 2011 where he won everything that he could win. And then just kind of went quiet for a few years, didn't he? And it'd be really interesting to revisit that with him and ask him what happened there, because he was 29 to 33. These should have been the best years of his career. But, you know, when you talk about his versatility, you go right back to the start of his career and he won Het Nieuwsblad a couple of times. And that's usually a sign of a rider who can certainly ride on the cobbles and, you know, could eventually go on to win the likes of Flanders and Roubaix. So it shows as well, I think, how riders, and maybe increasingly now, are forced to specialise in certain events and certain disciplines. And he became an Ardennes rider.
Ironically, Rich, in his early career at Francis de Jure, at a time when the French riders and the French teams were not very competitive at all, the one monument in which Gilbert was a factor on numerous occasions was Milan-San Remo. He attacked 3 or 4 years in a row, I think, on the Poggio, and it looked as though that would be by far his best chance of a monument victory. And of course, it's the one that he's missing now.
Yeah, you mentioned 2011 and just how much of an Ardennes-type rider he was. I mean, that was the year that he won Brabantse-Peel, Amstel Gold Race, Flèche Wallonne and Liège-Bastogne-Liège. You know, Wednesday, Sunday, you know, however the races went. You know, he was absolutely head and shoulders above others with that explosivity that he had. A completely different type of skill set to winning a Paris-Roubaix. I mean, Flèche Wallonne and Paris-Roubaix are really quite difficult, quite different races to one another, aren't they?
I would say so, yeah.
That's stating the bleeding obvious gets what it deserves from Daniel there.
I mean, they're both outdoors. they're both ostensibly bike races.
How do you feel about Paris-Roubaix finishing on a albeit outdoor velodrome, Daniel?
Well, at least it's not Zwift. At least it's not doesn't finish on a computer.
Imagine that. Imagine they got there and they climbed on Zwift.
Don't give them ideas. Yeah.
Christian Prudhomme was standing in the middle of the velodrome handing out Game Boys. You had to finish, beat the big baddie on a Game Boy. Yeah,
it's coming.
Maybe
it's coming.
Yeah, they'll have a sort of the big baddie will be sort of 1972 Eddie Merckx, won't it? You've got to beat 1972 Eddie Merckx. Although that'd probably be quite easy now, wouldn't it? I don't know.
But chaps, the buff completely ignored my question there about Bettini and Gilbert.
Comparison.
Yeah, I also didn't. Mention that Gilbert has also won Amstel Gold Race 4 times, which curiously Bettini never won, and it was a race that suited him pretty well.
I suppose I think just the versatility that Gilbert has now shown. I mean, if you'd asked me this before he won the Tour of Flanders, I would have seen the comparison more, but I think Flanders and Roubaix, they require a different sort of effort, don't they? I think of Bettini as a I don't want to say opportunist, but I want to say somebody who was very smart and knew exactly what strengths were, and you know, a bit like Oscar Freire or somebody like that, was very good at winning big races. But I think the the fact that Gilbert has now gone out and won these races on the cobbles in a you know, in the way that he's won them, Flanders and Roubaix, you know, going out with 70 kilometres to go, striking out with that sort of distance. Nothing lucky about these wins at all. They've been kind of brave, courageous bids for victory that have ended up.
Yeah, I think you have to say the versatility of Gilbert is well above Bettini. No, I mean, just the fact that he's and numerically, I mean, he's won more races of a higher level.
Okay. I wouldn't necessarily agree with that, Napalm. You know, Bettini won a San Sebastian as well. He won
Gilbert won a San Sebastian.
Did he?
Yeah, 2011.
Okay.
Gilbert won two Paris Tour. You know, and he's got four of the five monuments, and that's we can now genuinely think, okay, it would be very difficult for him to win Milan San Remo with the eyes absolutely everybody. You know, his way of winning it. Well, he's going to be 37 next year. It's not going to be easy, but I mean, if he were to do that, it puts him on another level altogether to Bettini. You know, it does. Okay, it might not put him up there with Van Looy, Merckx and De Vlaeminck in terms of the, you know, the impact that they had on their particular eras, but in this modern era, that would be an achievement worth a lot more than you know, I'm not belittling what Bettini won, but
I mean,
surely the
it looked to me like Gilbert went out and got that race. Yes, you know, he didn't sort of let it happen. He made it happen, and there was a moment, I think you mentioned it earlier, Lionel, where he was away with Sagan. Now, had he got to the Velodrome with Sagan, he would have fancied Sagan to win a sprint between the pair of them. And he somehow managed to sort of manoeuvre himself into a position where it wasn't Sagan that he was with, but Pollitt. And that was, you know, and I'd imagine he in his head, as soon as he got away with Pollitt, he would have been much more confident of winning the sprint. And so he committed far more to that move than the one with Sagan, and so he was clever, you know, and smart. But
well,
also
that's the most compelling argument for why Lampert was trying to, as Daniel was saying, shift that power dynamic in that front group and change perhaps. It so it wasn't Gilbert against Sagan, because they couldn't have known at that point that Sagan's legs were going to fall off in the last 10 kilometers, as they did after the race was done, really. But so that, yeah, that kind of starts to make sense.
Just a final note, champs. I don't think it will tip the balance either way on Bettini or Gilbert, but I suppose one would have to consider as well the era in which they've ridden. I mean, Bettini's best years were some of the kind of most unsavoury years as far as professional cycling was concerned. Bettini himself went through his career without really facing any strongly substantiated allegations of doping. There were certainly some at the 2007 World Championships in Stuttgart. There was an allegation about him using testosterone from Patrick Sinkovitz. But Philippe Gilbert, for the first few years of his career, I mean, he was very notable as well as a rider who was quite outspoken about doping. And I remember in the 2006 Dauphiné, he won a stage, and he told me a couple of years later that the next day, I think subsequent to things he'd said in his press conference that day, he got a fair amount of abuse in the peloton from Oscar Pereiro and Alejandro Valverde in particular. And this was a bit of a theme in those years, that he would talk about cyclisme à deux vitesses, the two-speed cycling, suggesting that the French teams and riders were cleaner. And when he left La Française des Jeux, he seemed to have got a little bit tired, actually, of that, of being that kind of go-to guy for journalists to get a quote about, you know, how cycling needed to clean itself up and so forth and so on. And, you know, after that, his stance and his attitude when he was asked about doping seemed to change slightly. There was an allegation, again, not really backed up, about cortisone use at Lotto Soudal. Or, sorry, Lotto, what was it called at the time?
Silence Lotto.
Omega
Pharma Lotto, was it? I think it was in his best season.
It was various names, but in 2011,
nothing was ever proven. And you know, I suppose that the whole topic, really, particularly as far as one day races is concerned, has sort of receded from the agenda, really. You know, it's not as big a topic as it was in the early years of Gilbert's career, and it's not something that he is frequently asked about. But I suppose it is just worth remembering that kind of backdrop to the early years of his career.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to our sponsor, Science in Sport. Very grateful to them for their support. You can still get 25% off all your sports nutrition products from Science in Sport at scienceinsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. And please do keep your questions coming to the Science in Sport experts. Contact at thecyclingpodcast.com. That's contact at thecyclingpodcast.com with any sports nutrition questions that you might have. Or leave us a voice memo at WhatsApp on +447971338205. That's +447971338205 for a voice message, a voice memo rather, for the Science of Sport experts. Well, we were going to talk a little bit about the tour of the Basque Country, but before we do, just a little bit of housekeeping. If you're a newsletter subscriber, you will have got a little teasing photograph last week of some beautiful Cycling Podcast mugs. Now, a bit of a story here, but a Cycling Podcast listener, Stacey Snyder, who lives in the US, in Virginia, I believe, she sent me a mug a couple of years ago, and she makes these beautiful, beautiful mugs. And we came up with an idea, and it was to have Stacey make some official Cycling Podcast mugs, sell them, in order to raise money for a good cause. So we're going to sell these during the Giro. They'll be pink at the Giro, yellow at the Tour de France, and red at the Vuelta. And what we want is nominations for a good cause. We're thinking a junior cycling club, perhaps a race of some description, anything that you feel would deserve a bit of money. Not a fortune, I don't imagine, but a little bit of money to help make something happen. Probably for young cyclists somewhere, anywhere in the world. So please send us your nominations to contact at thecyclingpodcast.com. And over the next few weeks, we'll consider any nominations and pick a good cause to support during the Giro. And we'll do a different one at the Tour and a different one in the Vuelta. And I must say, the mugs, if you've seen them in the newsletter, and we'll post pictures on social media at some point as well, the mugs are absolutely beautiful, so well worth owning. Another bit of housekeeping: if you are a friend of the podcast, you will get very soon a couple of new specials, which perhaps, well, I hinted at one in my package from Roubaix. That's following Marco Haller and Bernard Eisel. Daniel, any news on that?
Well, it's imminent. It's about to drop.
I mean, you've been working on this for a year.
This will go straight over your head, Rich. This will go straight over your head, but it's a bit like Dr. Dre's Detox album. It was rumoured for a long time, years in fact, and then it finally dropped.
You should explain though that Marco Haller, I mean, we heard from him a bit earlier that he was hit by a car while training with Bernard Eisel. Eisel had a similar, well, a bad crash around the same time, and also, you know, had sort of career threatening injuries, but Haller almost lost his leg and, you know, came back to finish 16th, I think he was, at Paris-Roubaix, and obviously perform a very useful role for his teammate as well. So you've been following him. I mean, you've been working on this with him for the last year, following his recovery.
Yes, and Bernie Eisel as well. We've regularly checked in with both of them over the course of the year.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing this when it lands. And also a Patrick Lefebvre special, Lionel. That's been almost as long in the works.
No, it hasn't. We've just had one or two.
I mean, he was asking about it. You know, that he was in a bit of a grump because
although
he was happy. Don't get me wrong. He was happy that Philippe Gilbert won Paris-Roubaix, but he was also a little bit miffed that your coffee with Patrick Lefebvre hasn't seen the light of day yet.
This week, Richard, it will be out before.
It put a little bit of a cloud over his day. Oh. I think.
ridiculous.
Poor old Patrick.
So this week for Friends of the Podcast, we've got Patrick Lefevre, Coffee With. Next week, Mark O'Haller and Bernie Eisel's comebacks from very bad injuries. And the following week, I'm off to the Ardennes. Flesh Wallonne and Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and we'll put that out after those two races. So sign up as a
friend of the podcast.
Yeah, it's only £15. It's thecyclingpodcast.com/friends to find out how to sign up. Yeah, you can pay a bit more if you want. If you'd like to support what we do all year round, your support is very much appreciated because it keeps us on the road at the Grand Tours, which are coming up very soon.
Yeah, it really does help us get out and about. And, you know, I've been at Tour Flanders, Pyre Bay, Skelderprijs. I'm going to Brabantse Peel this week. That's all helped enormously by your support through our Friends of the Podcast program. And thanks very much as well to those of you who've come up to say hello at these races. That's very nice, especially if you are a friend of the podcast, although it's nice if you're not as well. And the Friends of Podcast money helped me to buy a replacement car after Pyre Bay, having lost my car in Roubaix.
Don't be ridiculous.
That's all nice. And Lyle, a new rug. How's your heel this week?
My heel is fine. Thank you.
Forgot to check in with that. Anyway, enough nonsense, but thanks very much for your support if you are a friend of the podcast. Tour of the Basque Country, I was actually at the Bora Hansgrohe team hotel on Friday as we watched Emmanuel Buchmann win that stage, take the jersey from Max Schachmann. They'd had an amazing week, and you looked at that performance. I was watching, as I say, with some Bora Hansgrohe team members, and they were sort of purring watching this and saying, yeah, we've also got, you know, Rafał Majka and Davide Formolo away altitude training at the moment. And you think, that's quite a team of riders who are, you know, very good stage racers that they've built, almost separate to Peter Sagan and his classics team, which I put this on Twitter, but when he joined Bora Hansgrohe and they moved into the World Tour, you wondered whether they would be a one-man team. And they're very much not a one-man team, and they're you know, winning all over the place. In fact, it's on the classic side of things that they're not doing quite so well.
Sagan was my tip, of course, wasn't he, for Roubaix?
He was
top of my list. I know we wanted to move on to the Tour of the Basque Country now, but just on Sagan yesterday, Rich, I don't know if you noticed, with about 25k to go, he was eating and drinking an awful lot, and I thought this was a sign that whatever lessons he needed to learn from previous years he had, and this was you know, him using all of his experience, and he was going to absolutely well take care of the Gilbert and Pollitt in the finale. But he spectacularly ran out of energy, didn't he?
Which we've seen him do before. As you say, he did it a couple of years ago, didn't he?
Yeah, and that can be a sign of one of two things, can't it? That someone is playing it very smartly and they're right on top of their nutrition, or they're sort of in emergency mode and they know they're about to bonk at any moment. And I think it was the latter with Sagan. But yeah, Bora have been very impressive. I don't think they've got a Grand Tour winner in their ranks, but certainly they've got some very good riders, and Buchmann is getting better and better. It's going to be really interesting to see how he gets on the Tour, because he's someone who looks very, very frail and fragile, and he is a very sort of shy guy, and you can imagine he might be vulnerable to pressure. And there's, you know, he's going in to the Tour de France this year in theory as their leader, GC leader, and you wonder whether he has sort of broad enough shoulders for that responsibility, for that burden. But he's becoming a very consistent rider in stage races.
Daniel, do you have a top 18 to look out for this week in Brabantse Peel, Amstel Gold?
No, I don't do an Amstel Gold race. No, people were so unkind.
Oh, no.
People have been so unkind about this that I'm giving it a break for a week.
Such a popular
feature. No, I think monuments and grand tours, I think. This
great. Something to look forward to.
Yeah, maybe next week.
C minus for your Paris-Roubaix effort.
It's Lionel that's doing the bullying, Daniel.
It's not bullying.
It's horrible.
If you're going to make a ridiculous top 18 prediction, then, you know, you've got to expect people to to judge that.
Yeah, it's better to predict the top three and get two of them right. Would be my advice. Anyway, shall we wrap things up there,
indeed,
fellas?
We shall.
Have we got some thank yous this week to say to friends of the podcast? Thank you very much indeed to the following people who have signed up as friends of the podcast: Hugo Lopez, Stacey Snyder, who makes the mugs. What took you, Stacey? Paul Oliver, Carl Husselman, Jan Schmidt, and David Tyres.
John Crowder, James Brownlow, Alan Patrickson, Michael Edwards, Joe Seed, and Christopher Thompson.
And a big thank you to Craig McCulloch, James Fox, Alex Lewis, Steve Dennis, David Carson, and John Piercy. Thank you for signing up as friends of the podcast. We really appreciate it.
And thank you to you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, Daniel. Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, Richnell.
You have been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com to get all the latest news and special offers delivered straight to your inbox. This episode was edited and produced by Tom Wally.